My name is Vesa Ollilainen. I come here from Finland. I have actually two part-time jobs. I am a research fellow at the Theological Institute in Finland, private theological institute. And then I'm also a theological expert at the mission organization, Finnish Lutheran Mission. And now I'm here to talk with you about the parables of Jesus. First, a short introduction, and then we go to my six rules. So let me just give a little bit of my background on how I approach this topic, what's the history behind it. I got my first Bible in my preteens and have been reading the Bible regularly. Since then, I got it as a Christmas present from my late grandmother. And so when I became an adult, I think I knew the Bible pretty well. Also, the parables. I mean, there were some things I didn't know, but I thought that I had some kind of grasp of what was meant. So then I went to study theology. And during those studies, I got my hand on Dr. Kenneth E. Bailey's books on the parables of Jesus, particularly the parables in the Gospel of Luke. And that those books were the kind of books that blew my mind away. He could bring the parables to life. I mean, he could give lots of background information, and the parables started to speak. I could see with my inner eyes how what Jesus was saying when he spoke about vineyards and kings and seeds and fields and sheep and coins. And I thought that now I know what the parables are all about. So after that, I went to do doctoral studies, specifically on the parables of Jesus. And look and behold, could there be more divergence of opinions on matters such as in the parable studies? I mean, you could find almost any kind of opinion and almost opposite. So one scholar could say that parables are self-evident. I mean, they explain themselves. They have a moral story, and there is no interpretation whatsoever required. You don't need any allegory. Skip the allegories because the point of the story is there immediately to be grasped. And the next one said exactly the opposite. He said that the parables escape every interpretation. They kind of make you a fool when you try to find a single or a major point in the parables. And then there were the others who said that the parables are open to multiple interpretations. You can interpret in almost any way possible, and no interpretation is better than the other. And then there were those who said that the parables are there to give you loads of information, so you can dwell on the information and make conclusions based on that information. And the next book then says that no, the parables are not there to give you information. They are there to shock you. They are there to stir you, to challenge you, to make you angry and even mad. And then comes the third book and says, no, you're all wrong. My truth is that the parables are there to persuade you. That is to say, they defend a certain point of view. They sort of come halfway. They accept some of your principles and then apply that to a specific case. So as I was wondering the promised land of parable hermeneutics, it turned out to be the proverbial place of darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And I think that was the time of my life when I had to stop pulling my hair. I had lost everything during those years. So what I'm trying to do is to avoid sort of two extremes. The one is the extremely confident, I really know what the parables are all about. And the other one is the pessimistic and despairing one. There is no truth whatsoever in the parables. We don't know what they actually are saying to us. I will not so much get into discussion with parable studies or scholarly studies on the parables. Those are in the background, but we're trying to look for more easy to handle principles on how to interpret and apply the parables that might be useful for us as Christians when we read the Bible, but then also as pastors when we preach or teach on the parables, and also, of course, to lay people if they are doing those the very same things. So I will try to explain six rules. Now, before I go into them, you might be good to be forewarned that you find some of the material confusing, and I'm not referring to my poor rhetoric and structure. There might be some things that might be even kind of provocative for you, but that is just intentional. That's a good excuse for me if you feel like he's failing. I will say some things that are perhaps not very popular among Christians when they look at parables, things that they have been thinking about. But the intention is precisely that it makes you to challenge your way of understanding your parables now and take a fresh look at the parables and your way of interpreting them. And in that way, perhaps find some good principles. So please feel free to challenge what I am saying and test it, and then you see what you think is most convincing parts. Just one more piece of information. You will probably notice quite soon that much of what I will be saying isn't specifically related to the interpretation of the parables. We are at the same time dealing with basic principles for biblical interpretation, general rules of biblical hermeneutics. I don't think there is kind of mystery box where you find the specific keys to interpreting the parables. It's not the rocket science. It's more of applying general principles. Most of them you probably know, but it's also an exercise in humility, because there are many things that are disturbing our understanding of the parables. So we try to apply those principles to the parables. They are in the background. I perhaps won't be too specific about them. You can tease out them for yourselves. Okay, so that's my introduction. And then we go to these six rules. And my rule number one, acknowledge your assumptions about the parables. Acknowledge your assumptions about the parables. Now, one of the famous parables Jesus told was about the man who had 100 sheep. One got lost, and the shepherd left the 99 sheep in order to search for the lost one and find it. And when the shepherd had found the sheep, he took it on his shoulders and carried it home. And there was a celebration with the neighbors because there was a lost sheep that had been found. Now, key question. Who is the shepherd? Who is the shepherd? Yes, that's the traditional answer. Now, this was a trick question. To begin with, if you read a parable, there is no shepherd whatsoever. It says a man had 100 sheep. Now, you can interpret it that it is a shepherd. I mean, that's fair. If you are a herding sheep, taking care of them, you're a shepherd in that sense. But it doesn't use that word, which makes us associate the shepherd with the good shepherd of John, Gospel of John, chapter 10. Actually, if you read the context, that is the verses or precisely before the parable, there you have Luke's introduction to the whole setting. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, that is to Jesus. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So he told them this parable, what man of you? What man of you? To whom does this you refer? Well, Pharisees and scribes, right? Because it says here, and the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So Jesus told them, scribes and Pharisees, this parable, what man of you? So if there is any connection between the characters of the parable and the characters of the immediate literary context, then it's between the shepherd and the scribes or the Pharisees, and not Jesus. Pharisees, not Jesus. Now, second example. Think about the parable of the prodigal son. As a side note, I will spend quite a lot of time around Luke 15 because I know those parables better than the others. Think about parable of the prodigal son. There you read of a father who runs to meet his son who is returning from his life abroad when he spent all his fortune. And the father embraces his son, he clothes him, and launches a communal celebration because of the return of his son. Again, he questions, who is the father? And a traditional answer is, the father represents God. Right. You probably know this interpretation very well. Now, again, what does the parable itself say? Let's read the very verse I have skipped here, verse 21. And the son said to him, actually, the son says this twice in the parables. Twice we are told, Father, I have sinned against heaven, which is a circumlocution for God. I have sinned against heaven, that is God, and before you, my father. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. So the parable itself makes a very clear distinction between the characters, specifically the father and God. One of the major difficulties in any interpretation of the Bible is that people usually do not read the Bible at all. And of course, that brings some challenges to understanding what it says. Now, a second difficulty is the opposite to that one, and that is that we have read the Bible so much, we have learned it so much that we think we know what the text actually is saying. We don't simply pay attention to what's going on in the parables. It might be that we read a text so fast that we don't think through. That's the favorite sport of many Christians, right? Read a parable or read the Bible as fast as possible, understanding as little as possible. That's my favorite exercise, I have to confess. And related to it, when we read a parable, we have a preconception of what the parable is saying. We have been taught to understand it in a certain way. We have our favorite pastor explaining it. We have our favorite scholar explaining it in its commentary. And that has convinced us of a certain way of looking at the parables. So we simply do not pay attention to what the text is saying. So hence, here is my rule number one. Acknowledge your assumptions about the parables. Get to know what you think the parables are saying and try to look what the text actually is telling you. And again, as I said, this is a principle for any kind of biblical interpretation, right? We are just applying it to the parables. And in many senses, what the other rules I'm coming with are kind of applications to the first one. I'm saying it with different words and in different angles, but this is the basic principles. Beware of what you think about the parables. That might lead you in a very wrong direction. That is what creates this wheel of familiarity. We think we know what's going on, and we don't actually listen to what the text is saying. So let's move on to rule number two. Respect the context. Respect the context. A part of missing what the parables are saying is that we miss the context within which they are placed, or what the gospel authors write before the parable, right before the parable, or right after the parable. And as I mentioned, the parable of the lost sheep is a very good example of this. You have Jesus saying, what man of you, and we forget it, and then we think that it is dealing with the parable is primarily about Jesus presenting him. And here we have what influences our interpretation is of course John, the Gospel of John chapter 10, where Jesus says that I am the good shepherd, and that we know. And so when we want to read Luke 15 and then we read about the man who is having 100 sheep and then we have been taught that we should read shepherd, and then we make the connection. And so we use John 10 to interpret Luke 50. And of course, sometimes it is legitimate to bring information from the other Gospels to interpret the Gospel of Luke. I'm not against that in principle. What I am saying here is that the context of Luke 15 is quite another. You have there Luke presenting to us what's going on. You have the Pharisees, you have the scribes there. So if you're looking for a connection between the story and what's going on, it's literally context. You have to look at those pieces of information and not move to the Gospel of John and let it be there affecting you. In other words, you have to make a distinction between contexts and contexts. The Gospel of John, that's one context. It is sort of in the background of the Gospel of Luke. It's part of the New Testament, the canon. But then there is also Luke 15 and verses 1, 2, and 3. And that's the more direct context. And that should be the primary one for us when we try to make sense of the parable. So we need to respect what the gospel authors are saying before the parables and after the parables. Those are the pieces of information that gives us clues as to how to interpret the parable and how to apply them. They are closer to the original situation than we. They are closer to the original culture, closer than we. So presumably they know what they are speaking about. And here we could go into a long discussion with parable scholarship, who has a huge tendency to isolate the parables from their context. And of course, that's one of the reasons that leads them to think that the parables can mean almost anything. So we have to respect the context the parables are having. Don't forget the primary setting. That's number two. So then to rule number three. Beware of external information. Beware of external information. Now, the parables are fascinating as stories. And by virtue of being good stories, they draw you into them. You see with your imagination what's going on. They capture you. And they make you to start dwelling on certain pictures within the parable. About talents, about seed growing, about fathers running, and that makes you to want to know a bit more what's going on. Or perhaps your imagination brings them to life in such a way that becomes sort of information that you bring into the parable. So the way you imagine things going on, that's the way you start to read the parable. And then also the parables are not only stories, but they are stories that use information, pictures from ordinary life, from the reality that people are living in. They are not only parables. There is a realism into the parable. So they speak about kings, they speak about masters, they speak about servants. You have vineyards, you have crops, you have harvests, you have fig trees. There are houses, there are cities, there are roads, there are inns. And then there are these more, not everyday experiences, but the very important or significant events. Mugging, murder, punishment, war. So there is all the time a rich background in terms of culture and history and theology behind the parables. And we would like to get into contact with those information. And then also the parables by their very nature are very short. So they give us very little of information. Think about the parable of the prodigal son. A man had two sons. No more details whatsoever. Where did he come from? What's his what is his profession exactly? The parable hints at something, doesn't tell us. Where is the mother? Has she passed away? Or is this a patriarchal parable that looks down on women? That might be an interpretation by feminists. The parable is simply not telling us. So when they are very short and there is a minimal amount of information and there are many gaps we would like to fill in, all these things lead us to want to find, understand the details and fill in the gaps. So when you go to parable studies, they deal with in great amount of pages about cultural background. What were the gender roles in Jesus' time, and what were the tensions between various groups within society? Those who lived on the countryside and those who lived in cities, and those who were the elite and those who were the peasants. And so we are prone to think, we perhaps do not say it consciously, but we act in a way that we need all this background information to understand the parables. We need experts to explain them. The ordinary people do not have time nor energy nor means to do the scholarly work that's a prerequisite for proper parable interpretation. And of course, we who are exegetes and pastors, we may feel good about ourselves because we are capable of explaining the parables to people, and then they look up to us, admire us because of that. And as I imply, there are so many of these gaps and short pieces of information in the parables. Think about the fact that Luke 15 tells about this man who leaves the 99 sheep and goes after a single one. There are so many pages written about that situation. What's going on? Are we supposed to actually read the parable that the man dumps the 99 sheep in the desert for a single one? Because that's what the text seems to say. Or are we supposed to fill in with the background information, such as the shepherd guided the sheep inside a fence before he left them there in safety, and then went after the lost sheep? Or was the shepherd there with other shepherds so that he could leave the sheep with other shepherds while he went alone for the one who was lost? Well, we don't know. We are not told anything about it. Or think about the parable of the Good Samaritan. The story tells us that when the man was robbed and left there naked and half dead, by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw this half dead man, he passed by on the other side. And again, huge discussion. Why did the priest pass by? Maybe some suggest that maybe he wanted to protect his priestly purity. So if that man is dead and he touches the dead man, then he needs to go back to Jerusalem to purify himself. Lots of work there. He wants to do it. Maybe he's in a hurry back to get home. He hasn't seen family for many days, several weeks maybe. Maybe he realizes that they're robbers. He doesn't want to be robbed himself. So he flees away as fast as possible. Or then maybe he's just an ordinary people like we, that is a selfish, ignorant bastard who couldn't care less about fellow citizens lying this way. I mean, that's also a possibility, and perhaps even a realistic one. But again, the parable doesn't tell us which option is the true one. And here is my point. It doesn't matter. This kind of external information, it's interesting. It might give us a fuller picture of what's going on. It might bring the narrative into life, but it shouldn't distract us from what the parable actually is saying. What is said in the parable, that's what we need to know, according to the author or the first one who spoke this parable, that is Jesus. So don't look for the gaps or what is implied. Look for what is said in the parables. So external information, though it might be useful, it might distract us from what is actually going on in the parables. Again, let's look at the parable of the prodigal son. We can have a very interesting discussion about the younger son when the text says that he went to himself. Is it repentance or not? And there are those who say it wasn't. It was merely superficial. It was actually quite selfish. And there are those who say it's a vivid picture of someone repenting. And then a case can be made in both directions. But what really matters in the parable, it's told to us. And that's the father's closing words, right? The father says, it was fitting to celebrate and be glad for this. Your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. And that's the piece of information we really need to make sense of the parable. And that brings us to rule number 4. Find the emphasis of the parable and stick to it. I have heard my fair share of sermons on the parable of the prodigal son. And usually these sermons focus on the younger son's misfortunes. And they focus on how the father welcomed the younger son back home. And so the sermons deal with God's love for sinners, God welcoming repenting men and women, God's willingness to embrace his grieving children. And rarely do I hear a sermon focusing on the second part of the parable. And I think one reason is in the traditional name of the parable of the prodigal son. It leads us to stress the first part of the parable and think that's where you find the major point. But if the major point is in the first part, why do you have a second part in the first place? Isn't the second part implying by its existence that that's where you find what's going on? So what is said in the first part simply prepares the ground for what's taking place in the final sequence. The story unfolds and comes to its conclusion in the second part, not in the first part. So if you really want to preach the parable and what it's actually saying, you should go to the last part. And that's a general rule for the parables. If you're looking for the main point, look at the end of it. So, for example, if you look at the parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin, there you have Jesus telling us how to apply the story. Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. And verse 10, just so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, okay, you might have issues with Jesus' explanation. You have a coin that is being found. How does it illustrate someone repenting? You have a sheep being carried home. How does that illustrate a human being repenting? But what I'm trying to say is that those are side issues. Jesus isn't saying that you should allegorically interpret the parable. So you pick these single pictures from his explanation, and then you try to find the corresponding part in the parable. That's not his intention here. So, of course, I mean, we could do a lot of theology in that way, but again, we have the point in the parable which Jesus is telling us. So don't preach on what is missing in the parables. Don't preach on specific pictures that are in the parable. Don't preach on specific details in the parable. If you want to do justice to the parable, preach on where its emphasis is. And the parable's emphasis is in the end. So the end is there to disclose to us something that is crucially important. And this leads us further to rule number 5. It was implied in what I said, but let's explicate it here. Rule number 5. Theologizing tends to mistreat the parables. If I would be really controversial, I should say, run away from theologizing parables. Luke 16 tells us this parable of the dishonest the dishonest manager who is dishonest with the wealth of his master, as the name of the parable implies. And at the end of that parable, we read about the master who commends the dishonest manager. And that usually makes us feel uncomfortable. Why so? Because we suppose that the master is God or Jesus. So how can he commence an immoral act? And what makes us uncomfortable is our assumption about this correspondence between God or Jesus and the manager or the master. And the problem is not in the parable, but in what we are reading into the story. The master may just be a master in the story. The manager might just be a dishonest manager. Don't try to fit into a ready theological scheme what's going on in the parable. Or then, if you look at Luke 15 and the parable of the prodigal son, and you read about the father who is welcoming his son and runs to meet him, embraces him, and says that, bring quickly the breast robe and put on him and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. We might read that as an explanation of what God is doing to a sinner. And as I said, the parable makes a distinction between the Father and God. So that kind of reading doesn't do justice to the parable. Or again, Luke 16, you have the parable of the poor Lazarus and the rich man. And that parable ends with the rich man dying and being buried. And then there is in Hades, in afterlife, and in torment. And then he sees Abraham far off, Lazarus at his side, and you read about the great divide between them. And I have been asked, so we can communicate with people after death that are separated forever. And my answer is that you are theologizing the parable. It's not saying that it's part of the story. I mean, the major point is that if you don't listen to the prophets and the law, you don't listen to those who come back in resurrection, if that's the right theological term to use there. But in order to provide that major point, you need this conversation sort of in afterlife. It's not supposed to tell us. It doesn't give us a topography of how Hades really looks like. That's not the way we should read the parable. Or then again, Matthew 22, you have the parable of the wedding feast, the great banquet, that's Luke 14. And that parable is very interesting because first you have this welcoming for the people into the wedding feast. And then it continues that the king comes among those who are invited, there are the guests. And there he sees this man who doesn't have the proper clothing. And what does the king do? Well, he kicks him out. And so I have been asked with a very serious voice that, so salvation isn't secure after all. You can be kicked out of heaven. Right. Isn't that what the parable is telling? So the final judgment isn't final after all. And again, my answer is, you are over-theologizing the parable. It's not a story. It's not a theology in story form about the final consummation. That's not the way you're supposed to read the parable. You are not doing justice to the parable, what's going on here. So some reasons for why we do tend to theologize parables when there is no reason for it are, first of all, we think of Jesus as a teacher and as a great teacher, and, well, rightly so. And he is a theologian extraordinaire. But this also leads us to presuppose that when Jesus is speaking parables, they must be packed with theology. There must be loads of theology, and it is our duty to unpack it. There must be hidden theological meanings, even though we don't see them at the surface. And that leads to a second reason for our over-theologizing of the parables. When you read the parables, there isn't much of classical theology. Think about soteriology, or the doctrine of salvation, or Christology, the doctrine of Christ. When you look at the parables, they don't speak about Christ's death on the cross. They don't speak about his resurrection. They don't speak about the sins of the world. They don't speak about justification or atonement or the like. And that's one of the reasons, and this is a side note from the field of parable research, that's one of the reasons that liberal scholars very much like the parables, because they lack this classical, historical, Christian doctrine, the very doctrines that are important for us as Protestants. And that leads us to easily, that we tend to look at the parables trying to find there this soteriology or Christology. So, for example, you see the father who runs to meet his son. That has to be a picture of the costly love of God, right? Or you have the shepherd, or you have the father clothing his son. That has to be about righteousness, right? Or we have the man who's carrying this heavy sheep all the way back home. That has to be about the cost of salvation, right? Now, we must make a key distinction here. I think this is really helpful. Because when I do try to say this, people get mad at me. Are you against good theology? Are you saying I am a heretic? No, I'm not saying that. There is a difference between teaching faithful theology and teaching faithfully about the parables, interpreting the parables faithfully. So you can have a really good sermon about repentance or sin or justification, but you are preaching from the wrong text. You are not doing justice to what the parable is saying. You're speaking about something else entirely. So if you want to speak about justification, you might use the parable of the prodigal son kind of illustration. But again, be very careful, because that's what the parable is not about. It isn't said in the parable. It isn't implied in the context. It couldn't be grasped by the first hearers. It cannot be grasped in that sense by the first readers of the Gospel of Luke. Go to Romans chapter 3 and chapter 4. Galatians chapter 2 if you want to preach about justification. Preach about justification by all means. But you do not mistreat the parables in this way. Use the proper texts for the proper issue. So we shouldn't allegorize the parable if there is no need. If there is a need for allegorization, Jesus gives us the keys to that. He tells us when it is proper to allegorize. Every king is not God. Every shepherd is not Jesus. Every vineyard is not Israel. And I think this is a key point, because Jesus' parables are stories. And as the stories, they have to be certain events that carries forward the major point in the parable. And we don't need to make theology about those. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't any theology or ethics in the parables at all, but I think they are comparable to stories. So if you look at them, if you read, for example, J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, and by the way, Tolkien was very much against allegory. He hated people allegorizing his book. That's not how it's supposed to be read. Christian allegory is totally against how it should be read and understood. But what he says elsewhere is that the parable and what C.S. Lewis says about Tolkien's book, it has in its fabric, in the background, it's the pieces that builds up the story are certain theological truths and ethical truths. They are in the background, they are weaved in the narrative, but they are not, they are serving the narrative. The narrative is not there to serve theology. So that's a key distinction we need to make when we read the parables. I have one more rule here. So rule number 6. Look beyond the parables for Jesus, the parable teller. As I said, I'm all for Christ-centered preaching. I'm all in for looking at how the parables point toward Jesus. And I'm happy with sermons that focus on Jesus. Happy with sermons that focus on Jesus, not only as a great moral teacher or example, but first and foremost as the true hero of the parables. But what I want to suggest is that you move a bit more carefully to that major point of your sermon. So when we read Jesus in the light of the parables, we should look not for the cross in the parables, but look at the cross to which the parables are directing us. So what am I trying to say here? I give you a couple of examples. Jesus tells the parable about the unforgiving servant. The king forgave the servant a debt of 10,000 talents, which equals roughly 200,000 years of salary. And that's, of course, a huge debt. And so we might say that, wonderful, the king forgives the servant such a huge debt. Now, can God forgive me my sins, who are much more huge than a debt of 10,000 talents? They are not simply against a rich king. They are against the eternal king, the eternal God. They deserve eternal damnation. What we need is much more than a king who forgives us a debt of 10,000 talents. Or think about the parable of the lost sheep. It's wonderful to read about a shepherd carrying a sheep, lost sheep, all the way to its home. And it's all well and good. And I think also our listeners can somehow make the connection to the bigger picture, but we have to explicate it sometimes. So the question is, if a shepherd can help a sheep like this, that's wonderful, but who can help me, a fallen sinner, who has not only ignorantly gone lost, but has willfully broken God's heart and God's commandments and deliberately rebelled against him? You need a much bigger shepherd for that. Or it's wonderful to carry a sheep on your shoulders back home, but who can carry me, a sinner, a broken human being whose faith so often fails, who has so extreme difficulties to endure this life here on earth? Who will carry me? And that brings us, that points us towards a Christ that has to be bigger than the characters in the parables. So when we read about the parables and we have these wonderful pictures of love and kindness and so on, we have to keep in mind that they are pictures, that they are there to point us to something that is the fulfillment of everything. I think a good illustration of what I'm trying to say here is in Luke chapter 19, because you have the parable of lost sheep that Jesus told. Then you come to Luke 19, where you have Jesus meeting Zacchaeus. You know, the short man who had to climb in the tree to see everything, almost like me. I have easy to relate to his situation. And well, Jesus met him and was invited to his home. And in that house, Jesus said, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Now, we notice immediately the similarity between the language of what Jesus is saying here in Luke 19 and the parable of lost sheep. Seeking, saving the lost. And we might jump to the conclusion that Jesus is the shepherd of the parable. But that's not what Jesus is saying here. He's saying that he is seeking and saving the lost, of which Zacchaeus is one example. Jesus did not carry Zacchaeus on his shoulders. He carried a cross. He carried Zacchaeus' cross, which is a bit more heavy burden than a sheep. So, yes, in a sense, Jesus is acting out what is told in the parable of the lost sheep. But no, in another sense, what Jesus is doing extends far what's going on in the parable. Now, in Jewish and scriptural interpretation, there is a principle that appears in the Bible. It's called Kal Vahomer. Kal Vahomer, which basically means should be interpreted as how much more. So if a shepherd manages to carry a sheep to its fold, how much more certain is it that God will carry a sinner to his heavenly home? If an earthly father can gladly welcome his rebellious son, how much more gladly will our heavenly father welcome us, his rebellious creatures? That's the idea of the Kalvehammer interpretation. And I think that's a fair tool to use when we try to explain the parables. And it's similar, but not altogether like the typological reading of the Old Testament, which comes into play here. Because you see, when you read the Old Testament, everything in the Old Testament is supposed to bring you to Christ. Everything is pointing you toward Christ. Everything that's said there. And I'm not talking only about the prophecies. I'm talking about the types of Christ, the Passover event, the Passover lamb, institutions such as the priesthood, the temple, persons such as Moses, Joshua, David, Solomon, you name him. They are all pictures of Christ, but they are foreshadowings of Christ. They give you a foretaste of what's come. They give an example about what's coming, but they are not still there. They are types. There must be something better and bigger that's coming on. And that's how you can read the parables also in this typological sense. So, as I said, the cross, look for the cross. But the parables, the cross is not in the parables. The parables are a road to the cross. They are signposts that point you toward the cross. That's what I think is the appropriate way to sort of make theology out of the parables, to look beyond themselves in the context where they are spoken before the cross. That's why they have to point toward the cross that's coming there. Okay, these were my 6 rules on how to or how not to interpret the parables.